This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport, powered by fans.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, whether that's Rovers throwing in a drab 0-0 in the Championship or taking Newcastle all the way to a penalty shootout in the fifth round of the FA Cup, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. So, the only thing left to say is, are you in? Order now on the McDonald's app, and you can also get rewards points delivered too. So, the ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants, 18+. Rewards registration required. Points only on menu items. Delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Hello, this is Sam Smodix here, and welcome to the 4,000 Holes podcast.
You are listening to the 4,000 Holes podcast, brought to you by the people at brfcs.com and sponsored by the lovely people at The Terrace.
Hello and welcome to the 4,000 Holes podcast, the What Now Show, proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. I'm your host, Roger, joined in the studio this week by Stuart, James and Ian, our usual show where we'll have a couple of topics to get into and some funnies hopefully at the end. It'd be great to have your company this evening. I'm going to come straight in to the panel with question number one, and that is going to be, as Rovers continue to inch towards Championship survival, has your opinion on John Eustace changed, either for better or for worse? And I'm going to come to Stuart. Stuart, you've not been on the podcast for a while. Welcome back.
Great to have you back here. Cheers.
John Eustace, discuss.
I remember when they appointed him thinking that's not a bad appointment. And I kind of still stand by that. It's not a bad appointment. I don't think it's a good appointment. And I'm not so sure it's an improvement on the last manager. He certainly, for me, shored up the defence. Seems to be a lot less attacking, certainly a lot less entertaining brand of football. We lump the ball forwards a lot more than we did. For me, that's a style of football I've never enjoyed watching because it's just giving the ball away. For me, the jury's still out.
I know we were speaking at the Plymouth game, didn't it, Stuart? You came and sat next to me and we were chatting at length through that game. And he said that the last podcast we did, anybody who's sort of following these on concurrently will follow in the Newcastle game. I think optimism was quite high at that point in terms of we'd put in probably the best performance of the season, or at least of 2024 so far. And as you said to me on the day, saying that podcast aged quite badly, yes, quite quickly with the performance against Swansea just a few days later. So that's where I suppose what my question is really getting at is that you can talk very well about John Eustace as the person, as what he's projecting out there, but then it seems like everything can be sort of swung one way or the other, almost like a political spin one way or the other. Plenty of draws out there. You're sort of concerned with those thus far? I mean, they haven't lost. Unbeaten sounds better than no wins, and they're kind of both correct, if that makes sense.
Obviously, draws are better than getting beaten, but if that's all you're doing when other teams around you are winning, you've got to draw three games to get as many points as somebody that's winning. As the number of games left that we've got to play gets less, it gets harder to get the points you need to survive just by drawing.
I'll come to you, James, next in terms of obviously listen to what Stuart's just said there about Eustace. Has your opinion changed either for better or for worse?
A little bit for the worse. I mean, when he was appointed, I thought, yeah, safe pair of hands. It's not a bad appointment. And then we had a couple of losses and a couple of draws. It looked a bit stale, and I thought, oh, we might struggle here. And then that Newcastle performance filled me with so much pride and actually made me enjoy being a Rovers fan again. And then Swansea comes along and, you know, absolutely depletes every single ounce of pride that I had. And then you're thinking, right, we have two back-to-back home games against teams around us and we should be beating them. And, you know, Millwall wasn't wasn't pretty, but we got a draw. And then the Plymouth game is where you just really went down in my estimations, and this is no disrespect to Plymouth, but they absolutely played us off the park that day. We should have been 4 or 5-1 down at half time, and getting 29% possession at home against the team that's around us, I don't think is great at all. You know, we scored relatively early on, and then we kind of just seemed to sit back, and we didn't actually go and try and attack to get more goals. We kind of just went, right, we'll sit back and we'll try and get on the counter. So after that game, Eustace really did go down in my estimation. You know, I'm now looking at the remaining games, and I've struggled to find a win. I think we'll draw our way to survival.
Well, I mean, if you offered me 8 draws now, and what's that, 50 points?
Yeah,
I mean, if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. But are you not encouraged by, I mean, again, we're talking about the Middlesbrough game. And again, I know doing these podcasts, they can age very quickly. I know we've got the international break coming up over the next 2 weeks and Good Friday at home to Ipswich, which no one's under any illusion will be a tough game. But Ian, I'll come to you and get you involved in this chat for John Eustace. He had a week to train with the players. There seemed to be more organisation. Maybe the McFadden sent off, for how good McFadden's been, and we were singing his praises, rightfully so, last week on the podcast last time. Maybe him getting suspended forced to be 4 at the back, where I think they look better. They look more solid, look more like Harry Pickering, look more comfortable. Hedges back, Tronstedt back. And just going through some of the fixtures, if you look at the results that have had, you can almost spin them in a positive manner. I mean, getting a point away at Cardiff, Ipswich go and lose there, getting a point at Preston. Preston have won, is it 7 out of 8? Only Stoke have beaten them in the last 8 games. All right, the Millwall game perhaps is a bit of a misnomer, but Plymouth, they didn't lose the game, down to 10 men for half the game. I feel that's sort of a game that they'd have lost against under JDT. Middlesbrough away at the weekend, they'd won 3 on the bounce going in. They were perhaps unlucky to catch Birmingham at that time with Tony Mowbray, who of course we wish him all the best in his recovery. But again, can you spin it? I mean, has your opinion on Eustace changed for better or worse?
I can't spin it better than you've just spun it, if I'm being perfectly honest. My expectations of Eustace were structured. I think I referenced him as Tony Mowbray light when the appointment was made. I expected a safe pair of hands, solid, unspectacular, dare I say, in keeping with the performance of our CEO. Yeah, we're not going to rip up any trees. We're just going to plod along. And what I've seen kind of like reinforces that view. I wish we'd won, clearly, at least one of the games just to get that monkey off his back. I think that's a major problem. As you say, looking at the fixture list, it's hard to see where that first win comes from, if I'm being perfectly honest. It could stretch to the 20th of April and Sheffield Wednesday. And that would be deeply, deeply troubling. There are some really tough games coming up. So I expected Eustace to make us harder to beat. I expected it to be less attractive. I expected it to be less energising. And he's delivered against all of those, to be honest. But I did expect to have beaten at least one of Millwall, Plymouth. I was hoping that we'd beat Stoke, and we did. I think there's a strong argument that sort of says we should bring back Damian Johnson and David Lowe for a game and just see what happens, and then give Eustace the game back again. So has my opinion on him changed? Not really. I think he's a safe pair of hands. He seems a decent enough human being at the end of the day. But I don't see John Eustace delivering a brand of football that will get us to within one game of the playoffs like JDT did.
No, but that's not the argument at the moment, is it? And I think that's what he's saying at the moment. And that's where the club is at the moment. We'll come on to Venky's in part two.
We shall, yes.
There's a lot to unpack there with them. But interested just to find out, just as we finish section one, we try and keep these sections as 10 minutes a piece. Confidence on staying up. Give me a number. Give me a percentage figure in terms of out of 100%.
50-50.
We're definitely going to 50-50. That's the level. James?
Yeah.
I'm going to put my optimistic head on. 60-40.
And Stuart, to finish us off?
50-50 at best.
So you're really concerned?
Yeah.
Well, that's...
Looking at the fixtures that we've got left, I can't see where a win comes from.
No.
Sunderland, Southampton, Bristol, Leeds, Wednesday, Coventry, Leicester.
I think Wednesday.
There's a lot riding on that Sheffield Wednesday game. There's a heck of a lot. You're hoping that you're going to win one against the head, like QPR did when they beat Leicester. That it's just a result out of nothing. Crikey, who could have expected that? And if that's going to happen, the chances are it will happen at Easter. So you're looking at the Ipswich game and thinking, could they get up for that, or could we nick a win at Sunderland?
I think it'll be the Southampton game will be shock a few. Personally, I think if it's going to be any game, I think it'll be Southampton.
I'd take smashing Leeds 4-0 if we're going to pull a surprise.
I'm not fussy about who we beat. I just want to identify at least two teams that we can beat, because I think that will probably be enough. I think the way things are going, 48, 49 points might do it.
I just want one to come in off someone's backside in the 95th minute and we win. I'd take that at the moment. I've forgotten what it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, the other interesting thing is that whilst a draw wasn't ideal at the weekend, the other results kind of going for you. Yeah. You know, if Rovers had won and Millwall win, QPR win, Birmingham win, like, it's just about finishing above two teams at this point, isn't it? And if, who knows, if 42 points is enough to finish above two teams, then that's the way it's going to be this season. It probably isn't, but Rovers have got to finish above two. Well, apart from Rotherham, of course. But
let's have your percentage, Roger. Where do you think?
I think I'm erring a bit more. Maybe it's a bit false hope or a bit sort of what I want more than what I think. Bit of heart overhead, but I think 55-45 in favour of staying up. But in terms of,
it's not 52-48 then. Yeah, that would be a very controversial percentage.
That would be too controversial. But what I'm saying is, I think they will win a game somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
And if they can do that, you're only another win or three or four draws off doing it. And let's face it, I remember the year Rovers played Leeds at home just before Easter, the John Stead match, John Stead season, should I say, and Leeds scored. And I think Leeds beat us 2-1 at Ewood. And I remember walking off thinking, oh, well, that's us down. And then they won sort of two in a row over Easter. And can they beat Ipswich and Sunderland in 3 or 4 days? And all of a sudden you're on 48 points and it could happen. It might not do it. It probably won't do, but I don't know. I think Rovers are going to win one of the last games, and if that puts them on 45 points, can they get a couple more draws? Can they eke their way to 50 points at this stage of the season? I don't know. The fixtures aren't great, but points on the board, the goal difference is going to be crucial. You know, they've got some teams who could potentially smash them along the way, like Ipswich beats Sheffield Wednesday 6-0. Leeds have been trouncing teams. Southampton have been scoring bag loads of goals, haven't they? As have Leicester. Yeah, it's on a knife edge, but I just fancy the games are just running out for everyone at the moment. And I don't know whether that's my optimistic thinking or not, but we will see. Anyway, that's what we think here on the panel. Of course, you can get involved in the chat over on the brfcs.com forums. We're going to be back in section two where, I'm sorry, we're going to have to do it. We're going to have to talk about Vinkies and that statement after this.
4,000 Holes in Blackburn, Lancashire. It's from a Beatles song. Give it a listen.
Welcome back to section two of the 4,000 Holes podcast, the What Now Show. Proud to be part of the TalkSport fan network. Roger, Ian, James and Stuart here in the studio this week. And this has been another day with a Venky's Club statement, which I will read to you. If you've not had a chance to read it, I'm going to read it as is on the Rovers website. And that is that the club statement says thus. The owners would like to assure all Blackburn Rovers supporters and partners that the club will continue to have their full support in the short, medium and long term. The ongoing court case in India is now related only to technical and procedural issues involving Venkateshwara Hatcheries Private Limited, VHPL, and should have no future impact on the owners being able to continue to fund the club. Even though the extremely challenging times of the COVID pandemic and during difficulties encountered last year, the owners have always supported the club, which will continue as and when they are required to do so. And in finishing, it says, finally, the owners would like to take this opportunity to thank all associated with the club for their support and have the full belief that under our new head coach, John Eustace, we can have a strong end to the current season. That's available on the Rovers website, the Rovers Twitter, all the Rovers socials. And come straight to you, Ian. You've been very vocal on Venkies and Indian tax law and loans and administration. And you and Stuart, of course, did a wonderful episode a couple of months back about this issue.
Mm.
Discuss. Let me know what your thoughts are after that statement.
I think it's a lot of words to say very little. I think the word should is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that statement. So the ongoing court case should have no future impact on the owners. So it suggests something that hasn't been emphasised in the press, that the whatever happened in court on the 12th of March, and there's been a lack of detail, whatever happened, a lot of it has been resolved, and we're now just talking about procedures and form filling and money should come over. So it does not definitively say what I would like it to say, which is along the lines of, we can now send whatever money we believe we see fit to keep the club ticking over without encumbrance and without needing permission. We can now assure all fans that transfer fees received from the sale of Adam Wharton and the likely incoming fee from David Raya can be used to boost the squad in the next transfer window. And we will make sure that this fiasco, furore, never happens again. And we can only apologise to the supporters, the players, the directors, the officials, the employees of Blackburn Rovers Football Club, who have spent the last X number of months feeling uncertain about their futures as well as the future of their club. It doesn't say any of that. So it's
that
a very
would have been
anodyne
a better statement.
It's a very anodyne statement that really is shockingly poor and lacking, in my opinion.
What Ian's just said there would have been a much better statement than what they've actually put out. It says everything and nothing. Surely the whole point of the court case has been about, what did they call it? Technical and procedural issues. What's changed to make it about that it wasn't before? And surely if it's all just down to form filling and stuff, that makes me even more worried, because you know what Rovers are like, we're filling forms in.
It leaves me more questions than it does answers, really. I don't think it solves anything. I think
is there any other part of the statement that really gets under your skin, James? I mean, obviously Ian's pointed out the should, and I agree with that, and obviously that's been doing some of the rounds over here. But in terms of patting themselves on the back perhaps for the COVID stuff and we've always supported the club. So after they've chopped their legs off.
It's that third paragraph, and it's the last bit where it says, which will continue as and when they are required to do so. I mean, are they not always required to do it?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't endorse that further. And there's a lot of conversations about what they could spend that isn't affected by FFP, and they've chosen not to.
Yeah.
So you only have to walk around the stadium and see the shonky state of repair of a lot of the ground and all the rest of it. And there's a lot of spending that could take place if they wanted to, if they were so minded, just to make the place look better and look more like it was in its heyday 30 years ago. That spending hasn't taken place for whatever reason. And again, without an explanation, without that level of commitment, it just leaves us as supporters saying, you're paying lip service to the idea here. Mm-hmm. So again, I've made this point before, we aren't Reading, we're not in that state. But if the owners want plaudits and want pats on the back, then come out and apologise to the uncertainty that they've created.
Yeah.
And say, this will never happen again. We are rabidly ambitious. We are determined to do everything that we can. Explain why you weren't able to support John Dal-Thomason. It was a rotten ending to his term as manager. But we had a great season last year and played some terrific football, mm-hmm. had two great cup runs, mm-hmm. and we got to within a hair's breadth of getting into the playoffs. I just think that I've used this phrase before as well, forgive me for repetition. We are suffering death of a thousand cuts, and there's nothing in that statement that suggests to me that there's the level of ambition and determination and vision that is necessary.
I think it reads like it's come from the club as well and not the actual owners. It's at best PR guff.
This whole saga of what's happened with the owners, I am absolutely certain in that something people might play down there has had no impact on performances on the pitch. I think it has. I really think that it's had an impact on the performance, the morale, the confidence, You know, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if some of them players are thinking, am I going to get paid this month? Am I going to get paid this week? You know, like, there's so much uncertainty, and this statement creates more uncertainty.
You only have to look at recent history, James, don't you, to look at it's had no impact. It has had an impact because we've had to sell Adam Wharton to keep the lights on. That's a massive impact. You can't say it's had, people can't say it's had no impact because it blatantly has. And that's just the latest example of it.
I'm going to ask the panel again, just in closing on this, on section two, in terms of if there is a little bit of ambiguity, which there is in the statement, does the club or does someone like a Steve Waggett need to come out during this international break and add meat to the bones? Or is it a case of this will do till the end of the season and we hope we stay up and then we'll talk about it? Or what would you do if you were in charge?
I don't want any more bloody statements. I'll be absolutely honest. I want actions. Because the one thing that will galvanise the fan base is to see coordinated activity on and off the field lined up behind a goal of winning promotion. So if we start signing players at the earliest possible opportunity, as soon as when the window opens, and the manager is gushing in praise because of the quality of the players that we're bringing in, and we see that money being reinvested, and we see the ground being tarted up, and we see money being spent, and we see ambition translated into action, I think season tickets will sell themselves. I don't want any more statements. Statements are empty, meaningless, vacuous PR guff, to use Stuart's phrase. I want actions. I want to be able to see something, point to it, sort of say, ah, that's good. They're doing that now. I like that. That's very promising. That will mobilise and motivate the players, the coaching staff, the directors, the fans, the admin staff, everybody. Everybody's got to be aligned. And at the moment, there's just no ambition there. There's nothing in that that galvanises you.
The only people that had ambition in the club over the past probably 18 months is JDT. He's no longer here. And I know he's not everyone's favourite person, but I think Greg Broughton has a bit of ambition as well. He's always spoke about wanting to take us to the Premier League, you know. But that ambition has to be matched from the people above, and it's not.
Well, of course, we talked about this on the last podcast, didn't we, about how the international break is the fabled Greg Broughton interview and what went wrong with Duncan Maguire.
Yeah, but I don't think I want an interview from Greg Broughton. I don't want an interview from Steve Wagner. I want an interview from a member of the Venkies, and to come out and just, if we had that little bit of transparency, I think, I'm not saying it gets everybody outside, but I think it starts repairing that severely broken bridge that is there. Greg Rowan will come out and do his usual interview, and you know, the one thing I hope from that is that hopefully whoever made the massive cock up on the Duncan Maguire deal has now since left. I mean, that would be something, but it wouldn't be a lot.
So you sort of same horse, different jockey sort of feeling.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean anything. This season feels like it's gone on for about 5 years.
I don't want to hear another statement like this. It's the same statement we've had for virtually the past 10 years. I don't think there's anybody at the club that is capable of doing what Ian's talking about. I don't think there's anybody there with the imagination or the skill set to do it.
The passion is still there from a lot of people, and that's the encouraging thing. When something like this comes out, is that people are passionate still. The apathy hasn't set in with the masses yet. It has set in with a lot of people. We all know people, I'm sure, who've stopped coming to the Rovers, and it'll be hard to win them back. But whilst there's a passionate group of people who are willing to challenge these sort of statements, then the club still has a future.
I think the key is season ticket renewals. What is going to motivate fans to renew, and what is going to motivate fans who don't have a season ticket to buy one? It's not statements.
No.
It's actions.
Absolutely. Well, that's our thoughts on section two. We'll be back after these messages. Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like seeing Sammy Smodic get the winner at Ewood Park. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximise your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Are you in? Order now on the McDonald's app at participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee, and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
4,000 Holes in Blackburn, Lancashire. It's from a Beatles song. Give it a listen.
Welcome back to part three of this week's 4,000 Holes podcast, the What Now Show, part of the TalkSport Fan Network. Ian, James, Stewart joining me, Roger in the studio. And my third question of this week is, the international break has finally seen Sammy Smodics be rewarded with an international call-up for the Republic of Ireland. Which current, or probably more appropriately, which former Rovers player was unfairly overlooked by their national team? Of course, Smodics has been crying out for Smodics to get a call-up for Ireland. James, I'm going to come to you first on this one. Who do you think of the current or former Rovers was or is unfairly looked by their national team?
I think it's quite obvious. Obviously, Adam Walsh has been picked for the under-20s, but I think he's good enough to go into the under-21 setup. So that's one that surprised me a little bit. I think if Hedges hadn't have got injured, I think he'd be in the Wales squad as well.
Adam Wharton, you're not saying to be in the England full team. You're England, on about 21s at this point.
Yeah, the under-21s and not the under-20s. I think he's too good for the under-20s.
And Hedges has played for Wales, although I think I'm right in saying he's never played for Wales whilst he's been a Blackburn Rovers player.
No, I thought he should have been picked to go to the World Cup personally. But
what's your thoughts on Messrs. Wolstedt and Ayari being omitted from JDT's first Sweden squad? Were you shocked, stunned, knocked down with a feather?
I'm not surprised by Wolstedt Smith. I'm really not surprised by that. I think Ayari's gone into the under-21s setup, which is probably a good move for him. I've been relatively impressed with him so far.
It will be interesting to see how JDT gets on. Obviously, the early fixtures, I suppose, he can hide behind the fact he hasn't had time to spend with the national setup. But Sweden aren't quite the force they used to be. If you actually look through the squad, not many of the bigger names of years gone by, like Zlatan, of course, and Olof Mellberg, Freddie Ljungberg, all these players long gone from Sweden. Didn't qualify for the World Cup last time, didn't qualify for the Euros this time, which, of course, in the expanded format shows where they are, and they're in UEFA Nations League C as well. So keep an eye out for JDT this weekend as he makes his Sweden debut. Stuart, I'm going to come back to you. Who do you think of the current or maybe former Rovers players was or is massively overlooked for their national side?
I don't really think there's many players in the current squad that can complain about not being in their respective international squads. The one that jumps out for me is Jordan Rhodes in Scotland, because he was scoring for fun, mm-hmm. and I hardly ever got a look in. There was rumours at the time that he didn't get on with the manager, but still, I think he was one of the players that was definitely overlooked.
Yeah, another name for the Scotland side at that time was Tom Kearney, who I am surprised to this day still has never been mentioned with any dispatches when it comes to Scotland national team. Of course, they've picked a lot from the bigger clubs in Scotland. Celtic, Rangers, midfielders generally get in. But yeah, Jordan Rhodes, that is a good shout. Ian, I see you've done a bit of homework on this, which I love to see. You've got some names to throw at us. All former Rovers.
I'm gonna go back. You'd be disappointed if I didn't go back, did you? But yeah, you've got to go back to like when we had a good time. So let's go back to the early mid-90s, and we'll stretch that to the early noughties to include. I've got five candidates who between them got 10 England caps.
Okay.
And three of those England caps were awarded when this one of the five left Rovers. So I'm going to give you five names of England internationals that won caps whilst at Rovers, seven caps between them. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Jason Wilcox on the left wing, Stuart Ripley on the right wing, Tim Sherwood in central midfield, Chris Sutton up front, and then a few years later, David Dunn in midfield. Seven England caps whilst wearing Rovers colours between those. The biggest travesty of the lot, I think, has to be Chris Sutton.
Yeah.
He fell out with Glenn Hoddle, so that was him done.
Yeah, I was going to get your opinion on that just before you move on from Chris Sutton.
Yeah.
You feel as... He's quite an acerbic figure, I think, is Chris. I don't think he minds being divisive. He had the sort of bit of a Marmite commentator and pundit these days. I quite like him. Maybe that's the Rovers connection, of course. He's got a place in Rovers history assured for the rest of time. But do you think he was right at the time, or should he have perhaps swallowed his pride and his medicine and gone and scored a hatful for the England B team and come back and sort of proved it on the pitch?
I suspect that he knew he didn't fit the Hoddle profile, and that being picked for the B team was a device to sort of for Hoddle basically to turn round and say, well, you've not done it in the B team, that's why I didn't pick you. So I think he knew that. I think rightfully he could turn round and say, well, look at how I'm playing for Blackburn Rovers and look at the goals that I've scored. I don't need to audition for the B team. So I think there's an element of truth in what you say, but also I think Glenn Hoddle had a pretty fixed view in his mind about the sorts of players that he wanted to pick. I take some personal culpability for him not turning up for that B fixture, though, because it was a game that was played at the Hawthorns in West Brom's ground. And I bought tickets for it purely on the basis that his name was being bandied around as being in the squad. I thought, oh, I'll go and support Chris Sutton. So I bought the tickets. He then sort of said, nah, I'm not playing for the B team. I still went to the game, and it was very enjoyable, but there was no Blackburn Rovers representation.
It's interesting, just again, another thing on Chris, it's interesting at that time, 1997-98, Chris Sutton won the Golden Boot, which he shared with Dion Dublin and Michael Owen. Of course, Michael Owen went on to have quite a successful England career.
He was all right.
Dion Dublin and Chris Sutton, neither of them really cracked it on that international stage or really got a...
Well, Dion Dublin had a broken leg, didn't he, that ended in... So he signed for Manchester United.
Well, this is 97, 98, though, when he was at Coventry winning the Golden Boot.
Oh, right, sorry. Right,
that didn't translate into England appearances.
No, no.
Whereas you think fast-forward the clock now, if a player, you know, people are raving about Cole Palmer, for instance, this season. I know it's slightly different because he doesn't play and he's younger, et cetera, but generally nowadays, if you're going to be a Golden Boot winner in the Premier League, you're going to be playing up front for England.
Yeah, I think he was hard done to, but as I say, there's a lot of players who have stories about Glenn Hoddle and man management, I think, or the lack of man management is possibly a recurring theme that comes through those stories. But I think your observations about Sutton as a personality, I just think... You look at Wilcox, Ripley, Sutton and Sherwood. Sherwood is the one that sticks in the craw most of all because he played his best football at Rovers but didn't get capped until he signed for Tottenham, which I think is a very, very token gesture. I'm glad he got the caps for him because at least then he can look back and say, I did play for England, but he was playing way better at Rovers than he ever was for Spurs. And then, you know, you saw people like Steve Guppy at Leicester being touted as the answer for England's left wing problem. And poor old Jason Wilcox, you know, got just 3 caps. And Stuart Ripley's were 4 years apart. Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, how can you...
I was surprised when I saw that stat, to be honest. Stuart Ripley only had 2 England caps. If you'd have asked me, I'd have said he were in double figures. But obviously
I think he was definitely at his peak in sort of like 92 to 95. Providing for Shearer, and it, to me it would have been such an obvious thing. But so you could make the same argument for Wilcox on the other side. Just lastly, then, let's finish on Great Arwood's finest, David Dunn. Again, at least he got 1 cap. Whilst he didn't rip up any trees in that match at Villa Park, he didn't really put a foot wrong, and it does make you wonder what would he have had to do to get back in that squad, and why somebody can be discarded after just 1 chance. I know the England cricket team have learnt that lesson and sort of give people a lot more chance to bed into international football. I think picking someone for 1 game and then discarding them is cruel.
I think Dunn,
unless your name's Joey Barton, in which case it's perfectly appropriate.
I think Dunny, sort of being an attacking centre midfielder in the era of Lampard, Joe Cole, Steven Gerrard, yeah, they had...
Oh, the competition was much tougher.
Was incredible.
But he got it. He got in for 1 game, didn't really do anything wrong, and then was discarded. And you're sort of thinking, I don't know.
The other
just feels a bit cruel.
Just going back to Tim Sherwood, interestingly, if you look back again, this wouldn't happen now, is that the captains of the Premier League winners from 92 to, I think it was 97 or 98, namely Tim Sherwood and Steve Bruce, never played for England at that time. Of course, whenever this conversation comes up, Steve Bruce's name usually gets mentioned. How... A captain for Man United. We think, you know, nowadays you think about some of the players who perhaps had less than convincing careers, should we say, your Wes Browns of the world or Phil Neville's of the world, who've got boatloads of caps because they play for Man United, and yet at that time their captain, their leader, Steve Bruce, 0 appearances for England.
On Steve Bruce, I think it was the Football Ramble podcast, but it was definitely a podcast I listened to while mowing the lawn on Saturday afternoon. Apparently, Steve Bruce was offered an England cap by Terry Venables when Brian Robson was his assistant.
Well, just to wear on an eye Bruce, tag. Here you are, Steve.
Bruce basically, to his credit, sort of said, no, you're giving me that as kind of almost like a testimonial. Thank you very much for your service. I've not earned it. I didn't earn it when I was at my peak. So thank you, but no thank you. Right. But apparently, Venables was prepared to pick him for one game so that he wouldn't be the best uncapped centre-back. And yeah, the comment on the podcast was, well, fair play to Bruce for turning that down, which I think is spot on.
Bringing it back up today just to finish off this section, James, how do you think Sammy will do with Ireland? I mean, as a Rovers fan who's not Irish, I must admit, I just want him to come back fit. I want him to come back raring to go. I don't care if he only plays 5 minutes, but I'd be happy for Sammy. What is the season he's had? A much-deserved call-up.
Long overdue, and I hope he has a great time, but I hope he doesn't get injured at the same time.
Just ask Ian to do a little bit of research in the background just for Sammy. There's some stats that were out on Twitter, I don't know if you saw them, about where Rovers would be without Sammy Smodics this season.
In the bottom three, would we?
It's 20 points, is it? 20 points or something like that? Without...
I feel the need to jump in here, because that's a... That does not compute. We would not play with 10 men. The games would play out differently. Other people would score. We had this conversation about Ben Brereton Diaz, and Sammy Smodic stepped up. So, no. I'm not right. I'm going to edit this conversation out if it carries on any longer, because it's nonsense. So let's have a look at what they've got. On Saturday the 23rd of March, they are playing Belgium. On Tuesday the 26th of March, they are playing Switzerland. So Belgium, Sammy Smodic's up against, is Kevin De Bruyne fit? Does he declare for Belgium these days? And then playing Switzerland on Tuesday the 26th.
It is nice as well just to have, I mean, I don't know what everybody else thinks, and probably the listeners probably will think the same, which is I am so looking forward to this weekend. No Rovers matches, blissful weekend. I used to not like the international break for maybe killing some momentum, but yeah, if you want to get in, it's Rovers fix, should we say, then try and find Ireland v Belgium on Saturday and Ireland v Switzerland, 5 o'clock kickoff on Saturday and a 7:45 kickoff on Tuesday. And of course, as we said, let's keep all fingers and toes crossed that Sammy comes back fit and healthy. We're going to round off with a little bit of any other business and some funnies. We'll be back after this.
It's Sandra Twinster here. Fuck you.
That's staying in.
Yeah. You've given him the longest one. You give
yeah, this is the longest.
Okay,
let's try again.
Welcome back to part four of this week's 4,000 Holes podcast, the What Now Show with myself, Roger, Ian, James, and Stuart. Joining me in the studio, we just wanted to finish on a little bit of lighthearted since the international break. And seeing as this weekend I had my stag do. Now, I was forcibly dressed up in a full Burnley kit this weekend, which was a particular low point for the stag do. Shin pads and everything for some clay pigeon shooting. There is a photo on my Instagram, although I'm trying to delete every other photo of me there. It also had 3-0 UTC printed on the back, which sort of rubbed salt into the already open wounds. But I want to know from the panel if they have any Rovers wedding-related stories. Or any stag do stories or anything Rovers wedding related. So I'm going to come to Ian. You've got a particular one that I know you've said it a couple of times to me in person, but perhaps...
Yeah, I'm rehashing the old material now, aren't I, Cleo? I need a new writer's room. But I want to take the reader, the listener, back to the 3rd of October 1992. And for many Rovers fans of a certain vintage, that's the day that we gave Norwich City a right good whooping 7-1. But not me. I wasn't at Ewood Park. No. I was in church getting married on that day and missed the match. So our wedding, I think, kicked off at about 2 o'clock. And we got to the hotel for the reception, and my brother-in-law, both my brother-in-laws, were signalling to the top table, holding up fingers, sort of like going, yeah, 1-0. Well, this works really well on the podcast, but you know what I mean. Left hand, 1, right hand, 0. 1-0. I went, what, Rovers? Well, yeah, 1-0. Then it got to 2-0, then 3-0, then 3-1, then 4-1, then 5-1. And at that point, I thought they were just winding me up or just wanting me to have a good day. And when all the speeches had finished, I sort of said, come on, what's the real Rovers score? And said, 7-1. You are joking. So what we had to do then was we had to have an impromptu meeting of the ushers at about 10:30. Yes. In the lounge, in the hotel, to watch Match of the Day so we could see the goals. And I think I remember watching it on Sky Sports News before we went down to breakfast the next morning, just to see all the goals going in. So the Rovers' biggest victory in decades, and I missed it because I was getting married. But I never forget the date of that game, you see. That's the one I've
And, of course, Norwich were top of the league, top of the Premier League at that time.
They were.
Into Ewood. So, they were. Yeah, very much one of those. I feel I started going to Rovers a year after that, so... I wasn't there, but feel as though it's probably the last great performance in the old Ewood, and it's kind of nice to see
the old stands
and the old terraces.
Because we handed West Ham a gubbing, and we handed Sheffield Wednesday a gubbing in the Roy Hodgson era. So I didn't feel too bad after those two games, because I did see those two. But obviously the 3rd of October 1992 resonates for me in a slightly different way than it does for many, many other Rovers fans.
Again, just in adding some meat to the bones or some colour to the picture, Alan Shearer spoke at King George's Hall recently, and I was at the event, and he referenced the chipped goal in that game as his favourite Rovers goal of his Rovers career. So, a memorable day for everyone who was at the old Ewood Park that day.
That goal was introduced on Match of the Day by Des Lynam as a goal. So he does the bit at the beginning where he teases, sort of said, you've got to stay on and watch this because there's a goal worthy of winning the Grand National Eurovision and various other bits and bobs, and it was that goal that he was running.
I was just thinking then while you were talking about that match, and I was thinking about that particular goal as well. Was it a chip or was it a dink?
Dink.
I think it was a scoop, technically.
It was a great goal.
Come what may.
Yeah, brilliant goal.
Leaving a hapless Norwich City centre back in his wake as he ran through. Sorry, Mr. Sutton. That's twice you get mentioned on this podcast.
James, you've got a nice sort of wedding related story about when you first met your now wife. Would you like to share that with the group?
So it was during our League One season, and I was trying to impress her, so I took her out on a date, not thinking that we would get promoted that night. Well, a little bit of hoping that we wouldn't, a little bit of praying that we wouldn't, so I wouldn't miss the promotion party. But took her on a date. I can't remember where we went for a meal somewhere, and I was driving her home, and I was like, oh, we just take her over, score for me, please. And she got up, nil-nil. I was like, oh, okay. 5 minutes later, she goes, oh, James, it's 1-0. And I just let out the biggest cheer in my car I think I've ever done. And, you know, I've rolled down my window and I've cheered out the car window, and the elation I felt were brilliant. But I was like trying to keep a cool head for the most of it, so I was like very impressive. But yeah, I couldn't help myself but let out all my emotion that night.
And the date went well, obviously, because you're now a happily married man.
Yeah, the day went well, and now married. It'll be 3 years this year, but on the day of our wedding, it was Preston at home, so I wasn't best pleased that I was missing that game, but I couldn't really complain.
They won 1-0, so...
They did. They won 1-0, and I won £60, so it was a good day all around.
Stuart, do you have any wedding or stag Rovers-related stories in the Arsenal?
We also got married on a match day. Myself and my now wife, I nearly said current wife, as I've had multiple. Myself and Vicky were season ticket holders anyway, so we were, both of us were a bit reticent about missing the game. But it was, you'll all remember the game. It's one that lives on in every Rovers fan's memory. The 14th of April 2001, and it was a 0-0 draw against Stockport County, obviously. I don't even need to tell you that. You'd have all got it from the day, obviously.
Yeah.
Other than it being a tremendously dull game, we had the waiters. We had the waiters giving us the score. We had, it must look pretty cool because they kept coming up and whispering in my ear all as though they were giving me some vitally important information, but no, it was just, no, it's still 0-0, Mr. Grimshaw, yes.
Here's a quiz question for the listeners then, predicated on that. Who played centre-forward for Stockport County that day? I've got it up on screen, so sadly my fellow panellists will have seen, because I just looked up the game. But the Stockport County centre-forward on the 14th of April 2001 was one Shefki Kuki.
I think you could have given me all night and I wouldn't have got that one.
Absolutely. I'd forgotten he even played for Stockport County.
Maybe some of the listeners were part of the 9,705 at Edgeley Park that day.
Hardy souls who made
just
that.
Go through the Rovers team. Listen to this Rovers team from, this is what, 23 years ago in the Championship. How would
I'm not capable of scoring a goal against Stockport County.
How would
County.
This Championship 11 get on against our current Championship 11?
So in goal, we have Brad Friedel. At right back, we have Henning Berg. At left back, we have Stig Ingebjørneby. Henning Berg must have been centre back because right back was John Curtis. At centre back, Craig Short. In midfield, David Dunn, Gary Flitcroft. Wide left, Alan Marn. Wide right, Keith Gillespie. And up front, Mark Hughes and Matt Janssen. That side would be top four of this year's championship.
I'd have some of that team now.
Yeah.
I'll say, some of them are in the 50s, but I still think they could do a job. I still think Mark Hughes could do a job, yeah. I have to say.
Well, there's our little wedding-related chat. Just for the record, my wedding day is the same day as Leeds away, and when I heard it was moved for television, I was like, yes! And then it's going to be moved to slap bang in the middle of my wedding service. So hopefully by the time I come out, Rovers are either well beaten or well on the way to a famous victory, who knows. And just to finish off, a little sweetener, because I'm pretty sure none of my Burnley supporting friends will be listening to a Blackburn Rovers podcast 40-odd minutes in, that I'm getting my revenge by making all of them sit on the Ewood Park table at my wedding. So needless to say, I had the last laugh. I had to get a bit of Partridge in there to close. Stuart, James, Ian, it's been brilliant. Thanks for all your company this evening. You've been listening to the 4,000 Holes podcast, the What Now Show, proudly part of the TalkSport Fan Network. Be sure to have a wonderful international break. Stay safe. Keep listening in to our many programs coming over the next couple of days and weeks. Ian, you've got some shows in the pipeline, some things for the listeners to get stuck into.
Yeah, we've got an interview with a Rover supporting musician lined up, which will be quite interesting. So that will come out this month at some point. There's also some interesting international themed articles on the website that's worth having a look at. We're speculating what the England Euro squad might look like. So there's plenty of stuff on there. And of course, on the forums, as you rightly point out, I don't think the We Are Going Up thread is much visited at the moment, though.
And of course, I do know that there is a deadline of today for the next edition of 4,000 Holes, which means that probably around the Ipswich game, if not the Ipswich game, definitely Southampton game. Keep a lookout for the next edition of 4,000 Holes, the printed edition with Scott up on Kidder Street and Nuttall Street, where they meet in the corner. So thanks for myself, Ian, James and Stuart. You've been listening to the 4,000 Holes podcast. Until next time, stay safe. I'll see you later.
They asked me once when I worked at Plusnet if I wanted to do the robot answer.
Yeah.
So we need a Yorkshire voice for it, and it was great. So I pointed out I'm from Lancashire.
Welcome back, children, to part three of this week's 4,000 Holes podcast with me, your host, Roger, joined in the studio by Ian, James and Stuart.
Thousand Holes, no longer just a fanzine, now a podcast too, but you know that. You're listening to it.
It's the 90th minute. All your mates are round. You've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Your mates already got booked for double dipping, and you steal the last nugget, snatching all 3 points. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. You in? At participating restaurants, 18 plus. Serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.